This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support for Talk Louisiana comes from Brian Lowe Financial. Your number is 877-217-5757. Our email is talk@talklouisiana.org, and we're joined by Mara Eliason, the well-known commentator for NPR, who handles legal affairs for the great network that is our parent. All the programs that Mara appears on are right here on this station, and also she is a frequent contributor to Fox News, and she will be the keynote speaker Friday at the WRKF Founders Luncheon. And good morning to you, Mara Eliason.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's an honor to talk with you, and you've been doing this a while, and most noted for your coverage of the U.S. Supreme Court.
No, actually, that's Nina Totenberg. Well, I'm the national political correspondent.
I know. I'm fully aware of Nina, but you, of course, were right there last year when Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed, and now the situation is such that a year later we may have another opening, God forbid, if something happens to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and this has a political component to it. I think you would acknowledge that, Mara.
Certainly.
What would happen, let's say, if Ruth Bader Ginsburg has to step aside, or if something worse happens and there is an opening? Do you think that we would have the same setup we had a year ago when, not a year ago, but a term ago, when Merrick Garland was nominated by President Obama and Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, opted not to have a vote or even a confirmation hearing for Judge Garland?
Because it was too close to the election, he said. But Mitch McConnell has already said that this time, if there's an opening within whatever it was, 11 months or 18 months, I can't remember how many months there was between Justice Scalia dying and the election. But Mitch McConnell has made it very clear he will go forward. As long as Republicans have the White House and the Senate, they're going to try to get as many conservative judges on every court, the Supreme Court and all the lower courts, that they can. So if Ruth Bader Ginsburg should step down or pass away before the next election, which means the Republicans still control the Senate and the White House, yes, they would nominate someone. And because the Republicans have done away with the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees, it's very likely that person would be confirmed.
No longer takes 60 votes.
Correct.
At one point, that was the standard, and that has gone away, and the Republican Party has the majority in the U.S. Senate. Some believe this is unfair and will set a terrible precedent. The Democrats may quite likely replicate this if they have the chance. What are your thoughts regarding this?
Well, that's really interesting. I think once you start taking away the minority's rights in the Senate, by the minority I mean the minority party, it's a slippery slope and it's very hard to reverse it. I cannot imagine that the Democrats would go back to the era where, if they were in the majority, where you need 60 votes for a Supreme Court confirmation, because that would give their opponents, the Republicans, who would then presumably be in the minority, basically a veto over every court pick from a Democratic president. So I don't think we're going to put the genie back in the bottle. I think there's been a lot of hand-wringing in the Senate about the way that the ending of minority party rights has changed the character of the Senate. It used to be a more collegial body. It was the place, the saucer where the passions went to cool after the House, which is much more of a majoritarian institution. But I think the big question is, what happens to the legislative filibuster? And there are a lot of Democrats who want to do away with that. And, you know, this has been a slippery slope. It started with Harry Reid, the former Democratic majority leader, who couldn't get any judges through for Barack Obama because Mitch McConnell was blocking everyone because he had a filibuster. So Harry Reid decided to get rid of the 60-vote requirement for lower court judges, but he kept it for the Supreme Court. Mitch McConnell takes over when Republicans get the majority back, and he decided, okay, fine, we're now going to get rid of the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees. I think he would have done it anyway, but he gets to blame it on Harry Reid and says Harry Reid took the first step.
We're visiting with Mara Eliason, NPR national political correspondent, and she covers politics and some would say, unfortunately, the judicial aspect of government has a political component to it. And the President of the United States, of course, has been under investigation, has weathered the storm to this point, and is running for re-election. The Senate next year, of course, is up for grabs, and many seats, and more Republicans running this time than Democrats. What are the chances, let's say, of the Democrats winning the Senate in 2020?
Well, that is a really good question, and they certainly have a better pond to fish in than they did in 2016 or in 2018. When you look at the map, you could see Maine, Colorado, Arizona. There are two seats up in Georgia, and they have to get four if they're not going to win the White House to get the majority back in the Senate. They could get three if they elect a Democratic president, because then the vice president breaks the ties.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it works. So there's a pretty, you know, it's a better map for them than it was last time, but there's still pretty few seats to get you to four. They'd really have to sweep the table. They'd have to get Maine, Arizona, Colorado, plus another maybe Iowa. It's really hard to see how they get four seats out of this map, but I bet they will pick up one or two.
Well, it will be fascinating to see if that happens. And, of course, the president is up for re-election. Polls show him underwater as far as his approval rating, but he was there in 2016 and won the election with 46.1% of the votes. What do you see as the chances of the president winning another term?
Well, I think it's funny. I just talked to a Republican pollster the other day who put the chances at 40% for the president and 60% for the Democrats.
This is a Republican.
Yeah, this is a Republican. But look, I think that the president's approval rating is probably not 46.1 right now. It's probably a little bit less. But his ballot and his approval rating have stayed the same no matter what. In other words, he has just not budged. He, despite a good economy, despite having complete control of Congress until Democrats took the House, he has just stayed where he is. He really hasn't expanded his base. He has kept them intensely supportive of him, which is his theory of the case of how he's going to win again. He's going to just try to get as many white non-college voters out as he can and try to suppress enthusiasm on the other side. One thing that I've been hearing from people is they say the best thing going for the president is the Democrats. The best thing going for the Democrats is the president. You've got a very unpopular president by historic measures, and you've got a field of Democrats, most of whom Democrats are worried about their ability to defeat Donald Trump. So I think it's going to be a hard-fought election, a very close election. I think it is going to come down to just a couple states, which is really unfortunate, but it's the way that we elect our presidents in the United States. We do it on a state-by-state basis, winner-take-all, with big states getting a little bit extra. So I think if it's a referendum on Donald Trump, the Democrats could prevail. But if it's a binary choice between a Democrat that the Trump campaign feels very confident that it can disqualify as a socialist, then I think the president has a better chance.
The Democrats right now have some seasoned politicians. We know the people who are running. They've been around a while, particularly the former vice president and U.S. Senator Joseph Biden. But past the age of 70 is Bernie Sanders, as is Elizabeth Warren. And then there's Kamala Harris. Those are considered the top-tier candidates. Do you see, Mara, anybody bursting through the pack to eclipse the ones that are at the front of the pack right now on the Democratic side?
I think the clock is ticking on that. I think the one percenters, the people who are in the way back of the pack, have a very limited period of time to burst through. I think Thursday night in Houston, where there's going to be a Democratic debate, for the first time we're going to see the front runners standing next to each other. Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Joe Biden are going to be at center stage. I think that's one of the really last good opportunities that the minor candidates have to break through. I think that you have the race is being cast in terms of electability. And Joe Biden so far has convinced the most Democrats that he's the best person to go up against Donald Trump. But I think on Thursday night you're going to hear Elizabeth Warren talk about her candidacy in those terms, electability, and Bernie Sanders has been making the same case. So I do think it comes down to Joe Biden versus someone. Is it going to be Sanders or Warren? I think Kamala Harris tried. She did some good for herself in that first debate, but then she just kept, really hasn't been able to break through to double digits. So Joe Biden, I would say, is the consistent front runner, but still very weak. Most Democrats don't think he's going to make it to the finish line, and he has a chance in every debate to show that he can perform. He ran twice before for president. Both times ended in tears at about 1%. He hasn't been a great candidate in the past. Maybe this is his time. But what I'm watching for on Thursday is who's going to emerge as the main challenger to Biden.
We'll be back and wrap it up with Mara Liasson, the NPR political correspondent. She's the person who covers the beat like no one else for NPR. And she will be the Founders Day Luncheon speaker this Friday. We're back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Mara Liasson, NPR national political correspondent, is with us for a few more minutes. She's agreed to stay with us to the bottom of the hour, and you can hear her and see her, and she'll, of course, expand upon the ideas that have been expressed to this point on our program Friday at the WRKF Founders Luncheon at the Crown Plaza. 877-217-5757 is your number for Mara Liasson, and as you can imagine, several people, far too many to get to, but we'll try to get to a few of you who want to talk with this seasoned reporter who, of course, is at the apex of politics as we know it. Has there ever been an era like the one we're experiencing right now, Mara?
No, although some people say the Civil War was one, but certainly not in our lifetimes or memories. No, we haven't. We haven't had a period where we are so divided, where we don't even live, we don't even share the same facts. There's no shared objective facts from which you can then make your very different opinions. We have seen an assault on democratic institutions, what I would call the fact-based institutions, like the FBI, like the National Weather Service, scientifically based CIA. We've seen an assault on them. I would say this entire period has been a stress test for democratic institutions. I think they're holding up. I don't think they've collapsed. But what's really interesting to me as a political correspondent is that our founders created a system, and I would say it was the most ingenious democratic system ever devised in the history of man, but they created a system that wouldn't necessarily prevent what they considered to be a monarch or someone with monarchical tendencies from being elected, but they thought they'd created a system to prevent that person, if he did become president, from doing too much damage, because they set up this complicated, frustrating system of checks and balances to prevent any one branch of government or any one person from amassing too much unchecked, unaccountable power. And that's what we're seeing now. Is the system going to work or not?
Well, we started with a discussion about the Supreme Court, and if President Trump wins re-election, he almost certainly will have at least two justices nominated and confirmed by Democratic presidents, Breyer and Ginsburg, both Clinton nominees. They're well into their 80s right now, and if, let's say hypothetically that happens, then it's not inconceivable that there will be a 7-2 split on the court as far as ideology. What would that do to our country?
Well, we have had periods of time in our history where the Supreme Court was at odds with majority public opinion. That's actually normal. What would be abnormal is if that Supreme Court went about creating, passing laws or declaring laws constitutional that created, for instance, a one-party state, or, did something to the architecture of the administrative state that left the executive branch unaccountable. I mean, depending on what that 7-2 majority would actually do to our system of government and to checks and balances, then I could tell you what it does to us. Whether that court would overturn Roe v. Wade, that's actually normal. That's just partisan politics. When your side wins and they can declare something constitutional, that's not the big game-changing decision. But I do think there are other stresses on our system that that are going to be confronted sooner or later. When people think that a system is unfair, for instance, when one party gets 46% of the statewide vote but ends up with, let's say, 54% of the seats in the legislature, people think it's unfair. I don't know how many presidential elections we can have where the loser of the popular vote becomes the president. We've had two recently. All I'm saying is that people have to believe the system is fair. When they don't, then that system gets changed for better or for worse.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Mara Eliason.
Yeah, Ms. Eliason, has the politicization of the judiciary upset those checks and balances to the advantage of corporate America and the disadvantage of the common working person?
Well, I would say yes. I mean, corporations have always had more power than the common working person. The big change that we've seen over the last couple of decades is that the common working person used to have an institution that advocated for them, which were labor unions. They have really shriveled. So the common working person doesn't really have, you know, a counterbalance to corporate power. And theoretically, the elected representatives are supposed to present that. But I think that that's why you see we're living through this era of populism on both the left and the right. When people, you know, the secret sauce of democratic capitalism is that it's supposed to provide broadly shared prosperity and economic mobility. When it stops doing that, people lose faith in the system, and then they're open to all sorts of potentially radical changes, like no more immigrants, no more trade with other countries, or let's nationalize the private health insurance system. So I think that's the period we're living in. I actually think that this election, even though it seems like on any given day the election is about you're a racist, no, you're a socialist, I really think what the two parties are debating, although not very well, is what to do, how to make capitalism work the way it's supposed to, work in a way that provides broadly shared prosperity and economic mobility for the most number of people. You know, when people think that when they work hard, send their kids to school, get them a great education, and then their kids still can't do as well or better than them, that means the American dream isn't working. And that's what's happening now.
Mara Eliason is the voice, and you'll see her Friday at the Founders Luncheon, if you so choose, WRKF's annual event at the Crown Plaza. And she is the rarest of political beings for more than 20 years. I think 22 now. You have combined your work, where you're best known, at NPR as the chief national political correspondent, with appearances frequently as a contributor to Fox News. I'm sure people have asked you about this juxtaposition. What are your thoughts about how effectively you've been able to accomplish being on, let's face it, entities known by the American public, fairly or not, of being on different sides of the political spectrum?
By saying the exact same thing wherever I am. I mean, I just give my analysis wherever I am. I don't say anything different on Fox, where I have appeared as a contributor for 20 years, than I do on NPR, where I have been a full-time employee for 34 years. I don't say anything different in either venue. Now, on Fox, I am on, you know, I appear on two or three programs, Special Report with Brett Baer. Sometimes I'm on the Sunday Show with Howie Kurtz. Those are, to me, kind of the traditional news shows with a panel of journalists or analysts talking about the news. I'm not an opinion columnist or a pundit, and I feel that my ability or my opportunity to be on both of those networks, obviously NPR is my main job, has been a good thing for NPR. It's been a good thing for Fox, and I think that it's possible to do that. I think there still are many journalists and many news organizations, and I count NPR among them, who are fact-based, mainstream, who try to analyze the news, not represent a particular point of view.
David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on with Mara Eliason.
You know, there's a right-wing station I have the displeasure of listening to from time to time where a regular guest calls for Hillary, the special prosecutor Mueller, Obama and others to be tried for treason and executed, and he gets a lot of support from the audience. If Trump is reelected, how far away are we from a fascist state?
I don't know the answer to that question. You know, I if Trump is reelected and he still has the Senate, what could he do that would be different than what he's doing now? In other words, what would be the guardrails that he couldn't break through? I don't know. I mean, that's a big question. If he said to he has said in tweets many, many times, not so much since Bill Barr has been the Attorney General, but many times he has called on the Justice Department to prosecute his political enemies, and they haven't done it. So what I was saying before about a stress test on democratic institutions and that so far they're holding up is if we were truly in a fascist state, the president's former campaign manager would not be sitting in jail today. In other words, if the judiciary truly was just a tool of the executive branch, that wouldn't happen.
Thank you, Mara Liasson. We'll see you Friday. Appreciate your time and your insights. As always, the best in the business. Now the
Thank
news
you very much.
On WRKF.